Hello and welcome to Intrepid Heroes Presents, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. With me today is Joe Piscini. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so Joe became the Starfinder lead designer this year after previously serving as a developer and editor. Joe, can you tell us a little bit about your current role and how it differs from what you were doing before?
Yeah, it's been a precipitous rise, I guess. Now that I'm a lead designer here at Paizo, for Starfinder specifically, I have a lot more responsibilities in terms of keeping track of FAQs and errata to the game. But a lot of my work is still revolving around development work. But now I just get to tinker more with spreadsheets and dive deeper into the math, which is something I like to do.
Yeah, so I've talked to other people before about what developers do. Can you talk a little bit about what you did as an editor and see, kind of talk about the differences there?
Yeah, so between editing and developing, it turns out that when I was editing, I was trying to be a developer and didn't realize it. I would, again, constantly dive into the math, which would drive my managing developer crazy because I'm trying to step outside the scope a little bit sometimes of what editing is, but I worked very closely with developers. Editors do a great job of looking at, well, let me start from the beginning, right? A developer takes an idea, outlines it for, and I've heard other interviews on your podcast talk about this, but just to recap, they'll outline an idea, we send it to freelancers who write it up for us, and then we will do a developmental edit, basically, is what it's called elsewhere, where we clean it up, we make sure it matches the system that we've set up here, and the rules, most importantly for me, especially as lead designer. And then we kick that over to both our art team and the edit team, who then make it look good and read well, respectively. And so the editors, they're responsible for, you know, style things like bolds and italics and you know, how do we usually present a starship or an augmentation?
So they come in after that then, after the development process has gone through. Okay.
Although then they come back to us with questions like, did you really mean for this rifle to do D810 damage? It's like, no, that should probably be a D10.
Oh, so they're like a last check also.
Oh, absolutely. And they do several passes, as many as we have time for, honestly. And it's really great because everybody, you know, when I was an editor, I would catch certain things more than I would others. You know, we all have our strengths. Editors back each other up and they back us up as developers.
So if we find, I run a lot of scenarios for society play, and invariably you find errors and stuff like that. Who's to blame for those? Is that the editor? Is that the developer?
I think that human nature. I feel really badly for our editors when, now I'm wondering if I use that adverb right, when I see things on forums or in the public about, you know, oh, what sloppy editing or the editors didn't do their work on this, like, well, something's always going to get through. But everyone here works so hard to make it as good as it can be. Yeah. And I think we do a really good job.
No, I think it's great. It's when you consider that it's like maybe, you know, one word out of 10,000.
Yeah.
Like it's out. It's like, that's a pretty low error rate, you know.
Yeah, it's not
bad. So, how did you get started at Paizo and kind of what led to this current position you're in now?
Well, I draw a sort of line at where I got started in this industry at editing for Nintendo as a contractor.
Oh,
so I did some editing in video games. And then after that, I started as a contract editor for Paizo. Mm-hmm. I did like some remote assignment and then joined as a contract editor and then a full-time was hired on as an editor. Paizo.
So you've been local here for a while then?
It's been a few years now. And I joined Paizo just as a contract editor just when the Starfinder core rulebook was hitting edit.
Oh, right.
And I loved the game immediately. Yeah. You know, I talked to James Sutter at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm actually newer to RPGs than most of the people here, which I think serves as an advantage a lot of the time because I'm not necessarily holding on to anything that
So what were you doing instead? Video games?
Oh, everything. I like board games a lot too.
Yeah, okay.
But I was running a 13th Age campaign for a few years before that.
But
I'm comparing myself to people like, you know, people who worked here when I started here, like Crystal Frazier, Owen Casey Stevens, Wesley Schneider, James Sutter, just all these people who have been prolific and in the industry for decades. running and making games of their own. Fortunately, I didn't really know them before I worked here. I would have been intimidated out of my boots to even talk to them. But Owen in particular turned out to be a great mentor. He was design lead before I became lead designer. So
I noticed the difference in the name, because when you took this role, I said something, and so Owen actually, I think, corrected that there was a difference in names. What's that difference?
What is the difference? You know, I've asked other people that to see if they to see if it means anything to them. I think it's just, for me, it's more of a, I am a designer first, and I happen to be the lead designer of Starfinder, whereas design lead is more amorphous and doesn't really tell you. It is a minor difference, I think, ultimately. But
yeah, I was just curious. I was just curious about that. So in addition to your development work, you continue to do freelance work. We're going through Dawn of Flame now, and we're in book two, but you were the author of book three and Sundivers. So how does that work, you know, being a freelancer and developer, and to what extent do they complement each other as well?
Oh, it's great. It makes you much more self-conscious about your work, because you know exactly what's going to happen to it when you're done with it. But it also, of course, sort of frees you to say, okay, well, here's my responsibility as a freelancer, which is to take this outline, usually, and flesh it out and make it more of a finished product. But I know that the developer is going to get in there and change a lot, not because anything I do is wrong or bad, but just because there are so many considerations when you're a developer. So many dials to tune in, and then 3 to 4 editors are also going to be looking at this and making their tweaks. So I think it helps me as a freelancer to see the bigger picture of, like, this is a group effort, and it's going to be like, I'm doing the lion's share of this effort, but and my name will be on the cover, and that's cool. But it takes a lot. It takes a village, right? It takes a lot of people to make it happen.
Yeah, and when you're doing the freelance work for Paizo, are you more careful with the work than for somebody else?
No, I tend to be the same kind
probably.
Too careful, probably.
Good answer, I think.
Yeah,
good answer.
Sure, yeah. It's like, no, I don't want to be hired by anyone else ever. Thank you, John.
No, I does Paizo encourage everybody to freelance? Because it seems like everybody that develops and does stuff, they're also, like, even your customer service people are freelancing as well.
No, we don't necessarily encourage it, but people, you know, we get free copies of the stuff that Paizo puts out.
Yeah.
And I think just the thrill of seeing a book, it's weird because, you know, we'll write it, so I see Word documents, and I see the art sketches, and then I see the final art, and then I see the final PDF that we review before it goes out, and all that is really cool, but when the actual book shows up, it's somehow different. You know, you're flipping through a physical thing that you helped make, and I think it's no surprise to me that people want to keep being part of that and say, like, yeah, this is.
So you get free books as part of being at Paizo.
Yeah.
And then when you are part of a contributor, say to the Character Operations Manual or Starships Operations Manual, you also get additional copies. Author copies?
Contributor copies?
Contributor copies or no?
We have just started doing that. We didn't before.
Yeah. I was going to say, what do you do with all the extra books then?
Well, that's funny. We just got contributor copies very recently for Alien Archive 3.
Right.
And so I just gave one out on Twitter because I don't necessarily need 4 copies of that book.
Right. So what advice do you have for people interested in freelancing for Paizo? And I guess even if they want to continue on and maybe even work for Paizo.
Working for Paizo, that everyone has such a weird and different path, and I artificially stopped mine at being an editor for Nintendo just because that sounds the most reasonable. Yeah. It, like, fits a narrative of progression, linear progression.
Oh, but you did a lot of other stuff in
between.
I've
done so many weird jobs, concurrently and before and after. So, but in terms of freelancing, there's a lot of great groups out there. There's Freelance Forge is one
at Kate Baker's place.
Yeah, she's great, and she helps run that, and they're just really supportive of new writers, and they have people of different experience levels that can kind of talk you through the questions a lot of new freelancers have. Mm-hmm. Another thing is Wayfinder, which I'm sure a lot of people have mentioned, but also sort of self-publishing. You know, this, we live in the future, so you can put stuff out there. I would never encourage anyone to work for free, right? But if it's something you're passionate about, showing that passion by saying, like, here's a monster I statted up, and building a body of work that way, I think, can really demonstrate to us when we're looking for new writers, like, oh, you have sufficient interest and motivation to sort of...
So if I'm somebody who's been publishing these things, either self-publishing, third-party publishers, Wayfind or whatever, mm-hmm. how do I get on your radar?
It's tough, right? Like, we are always looking, but there's a lot of people in the world.
Right.
But again,
right.
we do live in the future, and, you know, a lot of us are active on social media, usually our personal accounts, but you can find us there. Our emails are very self-evident. It's just usually our first name dot last name at paizo.com. You know, people should feel free to reach out. I know it's awkward. Going to conventions, if you can afford it, it's kind of a big barrier, is being able to travel and
but everybody
time.
Should go to PaizoCon because everybody's there. That's a big one.
Absolutely, yeah, it's a great one. You can find us in our blue shirts. It's a lot easier than usual. We don't usually have the uniform. So
if somebody were to contact you then,
yeah.
or somebody else, anybody at the organization, what would be a suitable thing to say, and how frequently should they attempt to do that? Because I presume you all don't want to be inundated with emails now.
Oh, sure.
Saying, I want to freelance. And
that's a great question, and that's something even our longtime freelancers have asked us. It's like, you know, because, you know, we only put out so many products. We only have so many things to assign. So even if I love someone's work and want to use them again as soon as possible, for me personally, that might not be for another few months or something.
Right, yeah. I mean, there are things that have just been announced now that aren't being published until next fall. It's like, you know, so long lead times. And so even if somebody were to present everything and then they might not hear back for months, we can use you, right? Mm-hmm. So not to have an expectation of an immediate kind of response on that.
And I mean, I do try to respond at least and say, thanks for getting in touch. And, you know, I'll usually have some questions like, what kind of, do you feel more comfortable with narrative or mechanics or setting or flavor? You know, what are your strengths?
And they shouldn't just say, oh, I can do everything then, right?
That is a common response because you want to be flexible, and that's, I totally appreciate that. But it is good to have specific interests, and that helps us find a good fit for you. And then something I say is, like, every month or so, especially if we've already established a working relationship, if you're just checking in every month or two, I think that's totally reasonable and it's not a big deal. And I honestly, when I respond, I usually will give some sort of timelines, like, oh, I'm not, you know, signing anything for a couple months. And so I would expect that someone would not contact me again for a couple months. But I haven't had the problem of getting too many people reaching out.
And there's different the different developers work on different products, right? So which products in particular do you handle?
I am mostly developing Starfinder hardcovers. Okay. So that is a very limited subset.
Right.
But of course I sit with people that assign AP stuff, and I'm right across the way from all the Pathfinder folks. So when we share that information, you know, and that's another reason we ask about interest, so that we can get people, you know, we can share that information and say, oh, I have someone who's, you know, got a degree in this, or who has worked this job, or knows about this and is interested in writing for Pathfinder, Starfinder. And that's info we can share and do share. Constantly.
So if somebody contacts one person, that might be enough. They don't have to contact like 10 people.
Yeah. And I would say, well, I wouldn't say not to do that necessarily, but you might as well just start with, again, targeting your interests.
Right.
Like, I want to know what you want to write specifically, and let us know, however you can.
So what's the build process work like when you bring, you're starting somebody from scratch, and their end goal is, I want to write APs. So they're not going to start there.
Sure.
They're going to work up to that. So what's an entry level point, and then how does that progress?
For me personally, I use monsters. I like, they're a great encapsulation of mechanics and flavor. You know, there's a little bit of everything, and they're not that long. So if it doesn't go well, it's not a big deal on our end or on the freelancer's end. And it gives us a sense of your strengths and, you know, how well you know the rule system.
So you might start with a monster, and then could you go over to Society for a quest pack? Or
Society quest packs are another entry level. It kind of, I would say it's almost each developer's kind of personal preference for how they want to try out a new writer. And again, new writers can be coming from vastly different places, like a new writer who's written for three different systems and demonstrated mastery of those systems. I mean, that's going to be someone who might be able to tackle something different than a brand new writer. One thing I want to say about freelancers and expressing interest too is that we definitely need more diversity in our industry, and including not just representation, which is on us primarily, but also in our authorship, which is also on us. But just you know, a lot of people self-select out, I think. They think this isn't for me because mm-hmm. I haven't seen myself in this media. But I just want to say that it is for everyone who's interested in it, and that mm-hmm. No one should feel like they can't at least reach out and express interest.
Yeah, and actually, when you look at Paizo and the staffing and kind of even representation in the game, it seems like you've made a great effort in that. The overall community of players doesn't seem like, you know, I've gone to Origins and Gen Con and several big cons this year. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem near as diverse as even your own staffing. So the pool, I guess, how would you encourage, or how do you reach out to people that maybe aren't normally in your player base to come in and contribute as well?
It's tough. I definitely keep an eye out for people who self-select, you know, who self-identify as members of marginalized groups, right? And mm-hmm. and you know, first and foremost, I'm looking for writers and RPG writers,
right.
But I also want to find people, because these games are for everybody, so right. they should be written by everybody as well.
No, I agree. And, I agree.
That's something, as you say, we make a concerted effort, and mm-hmm. Our editors are also a big part of that.
Yeah.
Since we were talking about that earlier, they really keep a sharp eye out just for inclusive language and
right.
not, you know, the opposite.
All right. So can you tell us a little bit about some forthcoming Starfinder products? We just had an announcement of both the Starship Operations Manual, also the Deck of Many Worlds.
Yeah, I'm excited about both. And I'm glad you told me which ones are announced, because I always have trouble remembering.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's funny, I talk to people and they say, oh, I don't know if I can talk about that yet, because I don't remember if it was announced or not. So okay.
Yeah, I'm currently working on developing the Starship Operations right. Manual along with John Compton.
Yeah, excellent.
And so that's been a lot of fun, which, you know, someone we know in this room wrote for them.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to talk about that, your experience, but
well, I actually haven't shared that much. That was pretty exciting for me.
Spoilers,
you know,
yeah.
To get asked to contribute a couple pieces there. Can you tell us a little bit more about kind of the impetus for why Starships now, and you know, where that fits in the bigger picture of, you know, we had the Character Operations Manual, Near Space, mm-hmm. now this. And so Near Space seems like it's, you know, more about the world. Mm-hmm. Character Operations Manual is about the players and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I will say Near Space, it definitely is a setting book, but it has a lot of new options for people mm-hmm. as well, which I won't spoil, I think, yet, although I will heavily spoil them in the future, probably. And then Starship Operations Manual is, you know, we hear people want more Starship stuff
right.
and more options. There are a few in particular that we've heard from the jump that people are interested in. Of course, Character Operations Manual, which just came out recently, mm-hmm. addresses some of the, you know, magic users not being
right.
able to contribute, or people who just have sort of strength stats
and
dexterity. So we've given them in the chief mate and magic officer crew roles, starship roles, some new crew actions that they can really participate in starship combat. And so this Starship Operations Manual is just building on, not building on that, but increasing the number of options. And
oh, so there'll be a lot more variability in terms of what players can do then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not necessarily new roles, but
yeah.
so many new things for building your starships in the first place mm-hmm. and using them. I don't want to say too much, but,
sure.
but it's full of stuff. It says,
will there be any changes to the actual starship combat?
Not fundamental changes to the,
so the rules
war
themselves.
System, yeah, we'll, because we'll, that's, yeah.
Right. Okay. Because well, mm-hmm. I know there's been some question about that as well.
Oh, sure.
That would be included, and
yeah.
I think people are interested in that.
And the Deck of Many Worlds, if I can talk about that
yes,
for a
that,
second.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
I'm super excited about this. It's coming out in January, and it's...
Oh, that's like really soon, yeah.
Yeah, it's coming up. A 110-card deck. 100 of the cards are world cards, right? So they mm-hmm. have pictures of different kinds of worlds on them on the front, and then all these stats crammed in on the front and the back of them. And what you do is you combine these cards, and like I said, there's 100. You combine them, like about 7 of them,
mm-hmm.
In various ways to get adventure hooks, to get attributes about the world, to get species that live there, both sapient species that you might be playing as, or talking to, and that would have civilizations on that world.
And these are existing worlds and existing species, or are there new introductions here as well?
No, all the worlds are new. All the art for the worlds is new, I should say.
Right.
And the species are, we have more than 100 playable species in Starfinder.
Right, right.
So each one of these cards has a playable species on it.
Okay.
And it also has a, what I'm calling a threat species for this deck, which is something that lives on the world that might eat you or have ill intent of some kind. Like, I'm just pulling some cards out right now, and it got Cybernetic Golem and the Stridermander, which is, you know, a Skittermander eater.
Right.
That was in Alien Archive 3. And these are pulled, all the species are pulled from existing products. And so you can go and learn more about them.
And so these are designed for somebody who is doing a homebrew and wants to get a start on where to go from that. Or could this even be like a random encounter type of thing? Or...
Yeah, I see it as something, you know, I grew up with Star Trek, and I always loved the sort of Planet of the Week kind of episodes,
right.
And I love sandbox adventures too, so this is primarily for world creation, because it gives you, with just like seven cards in like less than a minute, you have how much technology there is on this world, how much, you know, religion plays a factor, there's even an alignment thing that you get randomly. And every card is randomized such that every combination of any two cards leads to something completely different. So there's literally like millions of worlds you can make with this one deck.
Wow.
And then there's a bunch of weird adventure hooks as well.
Are deities included as well, or is that not something in there?
Religion is one of the attributes of the world. And the instructions tell you you can roll a d20 and use the core rulebooks, 20 core deities, see which religion might be either, you know, outlawed here or very prominent. So there's just, it's a creation tool. I'm excited to use it to make some characters. Like, you can make characters with it. There's some advice for that.
Oh, for like character backgrounds.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm from here, and this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Or even picking your alignment and class, maybe stuff like that. There's advice for creating settlements with it, but primarily, it's to make new worlds to explore and have adventures on. And it's pretty exciting. It's just a lot of flexibility in a relatively small deck. So
yeah, no, I actually enjoy the various decks, like the I don't know what it's called, the equipment deck. It's got like spells and it's not the condition deck.
The rules reference card.
The rules reference deck.
Yeah, those are fun.
Yeah, I thought that was really useful. And for me, the biggest issue I have for that one is how do I display it so I can quickly access things?
Yeah,
you know, so I actually use like a sheets of magic card holder, so
that's
that I
smart.
Can flip through it and pull it out. Because you're in a game and you know GMing, and it's like you know, I know most of the rules pretty well, but I want to be precise about something. And a lot of times you want to show the specifics to the player,
totally.
And just to be able to pull that card out really, you know, same with the condition cards, just to be able to pull it out really quickly is really, really helpful.
That's one of the things with the Deck of Many Worlds is these are just double-sided cards, but the way you lay them out.
I see. There's interesting dice. Faces on
there. There's also die faces that help you generate like how many worlds are in a system. You can generate a system with this, or how many of a certain species are on the planet. And it's not just, you know, there's Earth-like worlds, and there's ice worlds and lava worlds and all that kind of thing, and gas giants, but there's also some weird, like a toroid-shaped, where, you know, a donut-shaped world, and even a flat world, and all kinds of interesting.
So there are some new worlds that don't exist now?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of this deck is to make like completely brand new worlds.
Oh, okay,
of your own
creation. Okay,
and we'll have.
Got it.
Yeah, there'll be a stream up already. I think it should be on YouTube by the time.
Yeah,
this
probably.
Comes out, probably of us kind of going through how Jason Keeley and I, another Starfinder developer, going through how it works and making worlds with people. So.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. I look forward to seeing you again. Hopefully at PaizoCon. If not, do you go to other conventions?
Yeah, I go to Gen Con with the company every year, but I like to go to other... I just went to Board Game Geek Con for the first time. That was a lot of fun. They need a little more RPG representation there, but it is called Board Game Geek Con. And I like to go to some local cons like OrcaCon.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll see you at OrcaCon.
That'd be great.
So, well, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.